Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
We have sort of a problem here.
Yeah, you apparently didn't put one of the new cover sheets on your TPS report.
Oh, yeah. I'm sorry about that. I forgot.
Yeah.
All right, welcome in, everybody. It's Always Soccer in Philadelphia on a Wednesday afternoon. I am back from vacation, and when I say vacation, I mean that, you know, we just took our two kids to a different location. There's not really a vacation when you have two little kids. You just take them to a different area and try to survive and enjoy yourself. You know, we'll call it a getaway.
There we go.
Don't call it a vacation. Call it a getaway. You might have heard somebody chime in there, and he's nodding along on video that you can't see, but it's somebody who can relate to that, I'm sure, is a former Philadelphia Union defender. You see him on the broadcast now. You watched him play back in the day. It's Shane and Williams joining the show. How are you, man?
Good, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, no problem. I saw you laughing there because you got little kids too, yeah?
Yeah, I have daughters, so I know it all too well. And usually it's mostly a staycation where you just go somewhere. Usually park or somewhere.
Yeah, it's sick. You just kind of pass the kids back. But it's great when you think about it because you're like, oh, man, we're going to Florida. You know, this is going to be great. And then you think, oh, wait, you know, we don't have the nanny anymore and we got to watch the kids the whole day, you know?
Florida is a chore of the kids.
Yeah, yeah, especially when we when your plane gets delayed 6 hours and you're sitting on sitting at the Philly airport for 6 hours. But that's another story for another time. So listen, man, it's good to have you on. You know, we like to try to get all the former players on if we can. And you've been active with the broadcast and, you know, appearing on on PHL 17, and you're still active and you're in the area. So just give us the update, man. What are you up to right now? And how did you get involved in the broadcast? And do you like doing TV?
Yeah. So right now I'm currently coaching. Ended up just getting my B license. So starting to get that journey moving along and really enjoying that. And then the broadcasting thing with the Union kind of came about. Seba actually got a real vacation because he doesn't have any kids yet. So looking for guys that were still in the area. And I just happened to be in the area. So they asked me if I'd be interested in it. And I thought I'd give it a shot and see if I enjoyed it. And it's been fun so far.
What do you like about it? What do you not like about it? I mean, is there a challenge? Was there a learning curve to doing that? Had you done any kind of TV radio before that?
Definitely no prior stuff that I had done. I would definitely say that I was pretty nervous the first time I did it. So that was kind of weird, feeling all those nerves for just having to go and kind of speak on TV, which is something that I've done before.
Yeah.
And whatnot. So I kind of just thought of it as an interview from that point on. And, you know, with each time that I've done it, I feel more comfortable in doing it. And for me, it's really cool to see the other side of the game, which is the broadcasting and that part of sports, because it's a huge part. It's a big part of how these teams make money and things like that. So it's interesting to see how much goes into the process and how much time and effort these guys put into putting on those shows that go out with the games each week.
Yeah, it's great to see you guys on because a lot of the Union OG, like original guys, have come back around or maybe like are hitting retirement of, you know, age right now. You know, they're in their mid-30s or in their 40s or something like that. So it's nice to see Sebastian on there. It's nice to see you on there as well. I joke with my wife because every time I hear Sebastian talk, I feel like his English gets worse the longer he lives in the United States, because I feel like he talks faster and faster. I feel like his English was better when we were interviewing him 10 years ago versus on TV. But you know, if you pay attention very closely, you can understand it, you know?
Yeah. So for me, like just being around him in the locker room, it's like when your kid is like 3 years old and there's spitting out gibberish and you perfectly understand it. And how do you know what they're saying? You're like, oh, I just know. So like, that's where I'm at with Seba. Yeah, I don't know. Maybe he needs to watch more TV or do something. But like, he does such a good job of studying and putting down details and really taking his time to get the details right. So I definitely give him kudos for that. And this is the thing about Seba. He is very aware of his English, and he's like, terrible, and I have to get better. And so, you know, it's something that I'm sure he's working on, and it's nice to see him kind of work through it, because English is definitely not, I'm sure, an easy language to learn.
For sure. Yeah, listen, and I don't mean to make this a Sebastian pile-on. I think he would laugh actually about this, but I have a quick story to share. I don't know if I've ever told anybody this, but back in the day when it was the original group of union writers, like it was me and it was Matt DeGeorge and Tannenwald and Seitlin and all those guys, we'd go down to the locker room after a game, and Sebastian was always like really affable. You know, he'd talk, you know, anytime you needed a quote or something like that. But we'd bring the quote back, and then we kind of take turns transcribing the quotes from him. You know, we'd be like, Dave transcribed Sebastian last week. Okay, now it's Kevin's turn, or it's Matt's turn, or whatever. But I think it says a lot, honestly, like, to because you guys like don't have like a background in that. You know, I think for any athlete who comes into broadcasting after their playing days, you know, talking about the game and understanding the game, having played the game at a high level, that comes very naturally. I think the change is just trying to be, oh shit, I'm in front of a camera now, or like, you know, what do I do with my hands? You know, what do I wear? You know, things like that, which are kind of like the forgotten kind of part of it. But you know, you guys all have the knowledge, so it's probably just a learning curve and just getting used to the broadcasting itself. Yeah,
100%. I think for me, my first game that I did it, I had a hard time focusing in on, you know, the things that they're saying in your earpiece, the crowd noise, the speakers that are going on before the game and the music and stuff, and just really trying to focus on listening to somebody talk to you while trying to relay a point on TV. So like the first, like, wow, this is really a lot. And then, like I said, you know, with each time you get more comfortable, you know, after doing it once, you kind of know how it's going to work and how things are going to go. So it's definitely been fun to do it. I even just spoke with Jordan Harvey, who's actually doing it out in LA a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
So, there's a couple guys getting into it. So it's been cool to kind of get to chat with some guys that are thinking about doing it and that are, you know, now getting into it as well. You know, and I'm still pretty new to it. So Seb has definitely helped me a lot, and just knowing like the little nuances of things. And I think that's definitely been a big help as, you know, he's now been doing, you know, for a good amount of time.
Yeah, Jordan's doing it, Marisa Dew's doing it, Charlie's doing it. You know, even all the color commentators who did the union local broadcast all went national. Twellman, Martino. I mean, like, it's like a crazy long. There's a good story to be written there about like how the union ended up becoming this like broadcasting factory.
100%, because I remember Martino, and then I remember Taylor Twellman, and then, you know, JP's been such a legend for such a long time. So you know, that goes without saying, but they've always done a good job of getting somebody that's important. Now they have Danny Higginbottom that does, you know, the stuff with EPL. So like I said, you know, there's a lot that goes into that side of things that, you know, people don't get to see. And it's been cool to kind of see the process and how things get done from a day-to-day standpoint on the TV side.
Let's talk about the team itself a little bit. We don't have to get too crazy into like the individual details here, because the games are still fresh. One of them was at 11 o'clock at night on a weekend, and the other one was on ESPN Plus last night. So they lose 2-1 to Orlando. They get a 2-2 draw out at LAFC. They get a 1-1 at Nashville. They get a 1-1 versus Montreal at home. 2-1 loss at Toronto. And, you know, it's funny, man, because I sense like a lot of weird, I kind of like Negadelphia on Twitter, Facebook, other places today. And those places aren't necessarily the greatest source of information or for how people are feeling, but I'm going to take like the opposite stance. I don't feel disappointed or Negadelphia about any of that at all. You know, I think what people are saying is, you know, they're coming up with something like, oh, it's 5 games in a row that they haven't won now. You know, when you look at the further context for these games, like, okay, they had the 2-1 loss at Toronto, the red card that should have been called, that was that the disciplinary committee came back and said that should have been a red. 1-1 versus Montreal at home, maybe you want more out of that for sure. 1-1 at Nashville, you got a tough team who was a playoff team last year playing their first game in their new home stadium. The atmosphere is crazy. 2-2 at LAFC, you know you'll take a point anytime you go on the West Coast. And then 2-1 in the Open Cup. I don't really care too much about the Open Cup this year because I think they're an MLS Cup contender. So like it's not like super important to me that competition as well. If you're you know, going to be competitive in the main competition. So I don't know. Are you with me? It seemed like it was just a little like oddly negative for some reason.
Yeah. What people have to understand is that this is such a long season and they are picking up points, not only at home, but also on the road, which is extremely hard to do. Like we said, the game was at 11 o'clock. It feels like 11 o'clock to those players. Those players are only there in LA for a couple of days. So to get used to the time change, yeah, you're going to be awake and up for the game, but it's still an 11 o'clock game in your own, you know, nervous system there. So they've done a great job of picking up points. I'm sure that there's been some disappointment. They have one loss right now, which is Toronto. And like you mentioned, it should have been a red card and they probably should have won that game.
Yeah. So
for me, they need to focus on making sure that they definitely pick up points at home. I think that that's really important when you go through the season. And then any points that you pick up on the road are huge points. It's just so hard to win on the road. There's been some great, you know, new additions of teams with great new stadiums that are completely packed and are tough places to play. So, and as you go into the summer, you're going to hit different climates and all that stuff. So they've put a good start to the season together that helps them, you know, really go through the season now in a good place. It's definitely, you know, I've been on the other side of it where you're chasing the whole time. And it's definitely, it's nice to be in the driver's seat.
And let's be realistic here, Shane. And like, I look at the Eastern Conference table, they're at the very top. You know, I go back and look at the four games they played prior to the ones that I just mentioned, and they had like four straight wins or five straight wins or whatever. They had like four straight clean sheets. Like, let's just like back it up here a second and think like, okay, they weren't going to like go the rest of the season without conceding a goal. Like, let's at least like temper our expectations. It feels to me, and this is a good problem to have, honestly, because I think people know that this is a damn good team now and they got players and they got chances. And so they expect more of them. And that's natural with anything in sports. I just think sometimes we fall into this trap, and this is like a typical Philadelphia Eagles kind of thing. You know, it's like, they're not supposed to do shit at the beginning of the year, but they start out like 3-0. Right.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden people are calling 94 WIP saying, hey, I think Super Bowl, you know, but you got to like, at least like temper the expectations to say like, look, it's still May. It's a long season. Like, they weren't going to keep a clean. They weren't going to go 10 more clean sheets in a row. So like, in a way, I appreciate Union fans for expecting more and having those high expectations, but we just got to like temper it a little bit, you know?
Yeah. Not to mention, it's still a really young season. Like, they're still not even playing at their best. There's still probably more to come from them as they grow into the season and get more comfortable with each other. They're trying to fit in pieces with Uwa now coming back to full strength and getting other guys healthy. So they're in a good spot. They've definitely put themselves in a good spot. You still haven't even seen much of the young guys yet that are still, you know, I'm sure hungry to get minutes and to get games. So they've done a good job of rounding out their roster and making sure that they have depth in every position, which is not something that's very easy to do in MLS. You see a lot of teams that are really top heavy, but as you start to go through the season and you start to pick up injuries and suspensions and stuff like that, it becomes really important about the rounded out rosters. And those are the teams that normally go far.
You know, during your career, you played for all three coaches who have coached the Union. You played in a variety of different systems. You played for Peter, you played for Hack, you played for Jim, you played empty bucket, 4-2-2-2, you played 4-2-3. I mean, you've kind of experienced it all at your different stops too. And, you know, I'm curious as what you make of the Union carving out like in this understandable identity, this diamond shape, like they want to press, they want to promote young kids through the academy. It just seems like the philosophically, they're very buttoned up and they've been more organized than they ever are. And I'm just curious as to what you make of the whole transition from no sporting director really to Ernie to Ernst, and just kind of like this team, like in this franchise, has an identity.
Yeah, I think definitely while I was here, we searched for it for a long time and I don't think we ever got it while I was here. But you see it now and it's pretty obvious. They, you know, no matter what, they play a certain style of play. No matter the players that they have, they plug and play and keep it moving. So I think that's so important. If you look at the teams that have been successful in MLS, let's go with like a Seattle Sounders. they have a pretty strong identity, and that it's really important to have those things. If you look at, you know, even beyond MLS and the EPL or any kind of big team, they all have their identity and they all have a way that they want to play. And that's so important to a club and building a club. And it's not always easy to get that in the first couple years of existence. So I think that they're on good pace and a good track now. And they finally have something that they can, you know, really look back on and say, this is who we are. And this is what makes us a success. So I think that they're, like I said, in a good spot, and Jim's done a good job of creating that with some moving pieces as Ernie moved on and Ernst came in. So he's definitely done a great job to ride the wave and to get to where he's at.
I'm going to jump out of order here because that segues into something I had written down a little bit later. And one of the things that fascinates me is I'm curious as to whether guys like you and Amobi and Sebastian, like those originals who were here during the expansion year and the early days of the franchise, do you guys ever look back at that? Or do you look at the Union now and see that the academy is humming, the stadium is packed, the processes are in place, they have a great training facility? Do you guys ever look back during your playing days and say, like, man, you know, I wish we had that, or, you know, things might have been different if we had that, if we were further along? Or do you just chalk it up to say, hey, it was an expansion team? Like, you know, it was always going to take time to kind of get things going.
Yeah. So I think it's kind of twofold for me. I think, for any club, you have to go through those growing pains, and it was just kind of us that was in that situation and us going through those growing pains of not having practice facilities, not having a weight room, you know, not getting meals after practices and stuff. And you never got to see it, but those guys that were in that locker room during that time fought really hard for the stuff that the guys have now. So in one part, it's, you know, an honor to really try and help a club move along and move in the right direction and kind of put your imprint on something that's brand new. On the second side of things, I was actually doing, you know, a little bit of spring cleaning yesterday and came across an old team picture, and I looked at some of the guys on there and I didn't even know who they were. And I looked down in the bottom part, I was like, who is this? And it was Gilberto, one of the young Brazilian.
I remember. Yeah.
And I just looked at the team and how young it was. And I think that, you know, we had like two guys over the age of 26 and Brian Carroll and Chris Albright. You know, those are the building blocks. And, you know, it's an important step in any foundation for a team. And, you know, it's definitely, they've come out on the right side of it. They've started to do things right. And you see that the results come on the field. So I think the first step that they took right was understanding what they had in the youth system here and the players that were coming through it. And I think that really jump started the rest of it, especially once they start to sell players and really make a profit off, and they'll continue to make a profit off of it. I, you know, I'm around, you know, the youth facility, a good amount, just watching and seeing what's coming up the pipeline. And it's exciting. You know, we had the Aronson brothers who I think are doing amazing right now. And I think the younger brother has the potential to be even better. You know, so it's exciting times. And the fans should definitely be excited that no matter what, they're going to have good players coming through their system. The Union do, you know, a top job of not only recruiting players, but then, you know, growing them into being good players. So, look for that to continue. And that really is, I think, jump-started their whole process and their whole success. So, kudos to them for understanding what they have and really finding a niche that helps them succeed. I think it's important in an MLS league that you have some owners that have millions and millions of dollars at their disposal and some owners that don't.
Yeah.
They found a way to be successful in a way that they're not spending heaps and heaps of money like some of these other teams are.
Yeah. I mean, to Jay's credit, he did exactly what he said he was going to do. You know,
yeah.
Like, we're going to build from within and we're going to do this. And so I give him credit for it. You know, what's funny is, like, you know, the phrase you have to, how does it go? You have to crawl before you learn to walk, right? Well, I look at like you and Amobi and all those guys, like, you guys had to go to Chester Park in vans before, you know, everybody could walk to the practice facility, you know? So, like, in a way, it's like, I look back at you guys, like that group, and I feel like, you like paved the way and like were kind of the original group that like, you know, set this foundation that had to be like built upon, you know, because it wouldn't like you say, you have to go through those growing pains. I mean, like there's more resources in MLS now, but no expansion team is coming right in with all this amazing stuff. Right. I mean, look at like Miami, who we thought like Beckham was going to come in with like Ronaldo and Messi on day one, you know, right. Now they're still trying to figure it out.
It never works out that way. You know, you try to do what's best and without actually seeing something. Like you've never stepped foot on a field or into an office and you're trying to build something from scratch. And it's really hard. And the teams that are successful, like let's say like in Atlanta, they spent a ton of money to do that. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing, but they knew what it was going to take for them to hit the ground running and they were willing to spend it. So it's just a different way of doing things when you have a different owner. Jay's done it in a way, which, you know, like I said, Jay has done a great job. But at the same time, Jay didn't grow up playing soccer.
Yeah.
Jay's pretty this whole world. So I think he's done a good job of kind of hiring people and trusting the people that you hire to make some good decisions. And, you know, sometimes the people that you hire aren't the right people. And he's gotten rid of those guys and gotten guys in that know what they're doing and are doing a great job. So, you know, there's good and bad with everybody, right?
Yeah. Yeah. You know, one thing I just wanted to go over your uni career a little bit, but I wanted to actually back into it and kind of like reverse order, because I don't know, you're not that old, man, right? You're still like 32, 33.
Yep, 32. Yeah.
So you could still be playing. And I'm just wondering, you know, what made you want to call it quits? And I think you did, correct me if I'm wrong, but I think you tried with DC after LA. And I'm just wondering like how you came to the decision to stop playing. And if you felt like you could have kept playing.
Yeah, I think for me, it got to a point where, you know, I was only getting 1 year deals, moving from place to place. You know, I had a young family at the time and I just got tired of it. You know, I've been moving around since I was 15 years old. So I had gotten to a point in my career where I was happy with where I was at. I played in 200 games, you know, and I got to do something that was definitely a childhood dream of mine. And I had a ton of good experiences. But at the end of the day, I looked at my life and what was important to me and, you know, decided that I wanted to be close to my family. So I kind of just decided at that point that I would stop playing. And I think for anybody that retires, you just have to do it when you're ready. And for me, I know that I can still play. You know, that's definitely not a question. It's just, you know, I have other things in my life that are more important.
I have a Shane and Williams hot take that I want to share with you. This is something that, and so like, for a little bit of background here, like I was working for the team from 2010 to 2014, I think it was, right? So when you're in that lens of media, like, it's not that you're like super favorable to the union or whatever, but you just got to be careful. Like, I can't come out on the website and say Seattle is shit and I'm going to tell you why, right? Like, you got to button it up, right? You know, so, but you know, that 2013 season, I would have put you on the all-star team.
Yeah.
And here's the thing. Here's the background. I think people probably remember this, but that was DeAndre Yedlin's first year in the league because he had come up through the Seattle youth pipeline. And MLS at the time was kind of moving a little bit away from the kind of like the aging veteran superstar kind of guys. And they wanted to like push market their young players for sure. And they gave DeAndre this big push. And I think Garber picked him to be on the all-star team that year. But, you know, I watched all those games, man. I watched every game you played and I watched most of the games that he played in. I was like, you know, obviously DeAndre went on to have a great career and we all knew it at that time. But like, you had 2 goals that year. You had 8 assists. I think that was probably, I don't know if you agree, but I think that was probably your best career year for the union. But I would have put you right up there, man. I thought you were really, really good that year. And I look back at the roster today, I think Tony Beltran was the starting right back there, but like, honest to God, man, this is me being honest. Like, I would have put you on that team.
I'll be completely honest with you. I'll give you my thought process that year. I said, this is the best year I'm gonna have. So I put everything I had into that year and I was like, I'm gonna be an all-star. And when I didn't get picked, I was confused. And I was like, well, if I'm going to have 2 goals and 8 assists and for a good portion of the season, lead the league in assists and not picked, then this, you know, this wasn't meant to be.
Yeah.
But funny story too. I think it was in around that timeline. We were actually doing pretty well, and three players had gotten picked to represent the national team for Bob Bradley. It was me, Gabe Farfan, and Brian Carroll. Literally, I think less than 24 hours, Bob Bradley got fired. And Lensman took over and had just scrapped the whole roster. So that was an opportunity that kind of went out the window. And then, you know, once Jurgen came in, they went for this strictly European-based players, you know, mentality. And I think that that definitely played on me as well. And just being like, well, you know, if I'm not in Europe, that means that there's no national team shots, because that's really the trends that that was going on. So it just kind of just happened to be some bad luck, which, you know, happens. And I fought through it and I came out on the other side. But it's funny that you mentioned that, because I definitely remember that. And I remember being like, yeah, this is unbelievable that, you know, this is going to happen in this way, for me to have a good season and for me to be doing well. And, you know, that was definitely a goal that I had written down that year and I didn't accomplish it. So, I'm not sour about it, because obviously, you know, those are two great players that have done really good things, but definitely, you know, I was upset, as anybody that's competitive would be. So, you know, definitely, a year that I remember. I made some good bonuses that year, so I at least got something to take home for my efforts. you know, I'll take that.
But doesn't it, it's funny, because it kind of reminds me, we were talking about the Embiid, Joel Embiid MVP thing this year, and like your story is kind of similar to that in the way that like the margins are so small. And I think a lot of people don't realize that for professional athletes and coaches, like there's so many like little pieces of luck and things you can't control that are out of your hands, you know, like, you know, you could have the greatest season ever. And what if somebody else has their greatest season ever, you know, and like you're the top two right fullbacks in MLS, but being the second best or the third best right fullback at MLS out of like 50 some people, that's like a nice honor, you know, but and you can't control like who's coaching the national team or whatever. So
yeah,
you know, man, it's like these really thin margins, you know,
crazy fortunes that like he literally put out a roster and then got fired that day. It was crazy, because I got to, you know, I think I still have the letter somewhere, and I showed my mom and they were all excited, because the game was actually, it was against Mexico in Philadelphia.
Oh, so, man.
A really cool experience or whatnot. And it just didn't happen. But everybody's competitive. So, you know, when you start a season, you want to have the best season that you can have. And definitely, you know, Joel Embiid had a great season and is not going to, it looks like, pick up the MVP. So, like I said, you got to gear up and go again and try to replicate that. But it's not easy, especially in team sports. You know, that year I had a lot of good, you know, forwards, Connor Casey and that bald head, I think, might have had a couple at the near post. And, you know, we even, yeah. I think, you know, Aaron Wheeler chipped in some goals that year. So,
yeah.
It's just sometimes, you know, the forwards are in good form and you're getting the feed off that, and sometimes they're not. So, you know, I always try to put myself in good positions to attack and give opportunities to the guys up front. You know, and I played with some good ones, especially in Philly, and also in some other places.
I don't know why this is, but Zoom tells me I have 9 minutes left. I thought it was unlimited when you only had two people, but there we go. At least we have a timer now, and I won't keep you forever. Memories from your time in Philly. I love the 2011 team. I talk about the 2011 team all the time on this podcast, because I think, you know, for me, it was like, that was the first really good Union team, the first playoff team. Carlos was great that year. Danny was great that year. You were great. Jordan for the first half of the season. That's my first thought. I really loved watching that team. And I honestly, God, I liked the 2013 team as well. I thought, you know, when Hack came in, giving license to some of the young guys and kind of letting them play free and, you know, handing the reins over to some of the other guys on the roster. And, you know, you guys were in it until the very end. I think you finished 12-12-10 or something like that. But I focus on those two teams the most. I think when you look at like the OG Union teams or whatever, you know, when you look back at that era, what do you think?
2011 team, I think, definitely could have won something. I think the turning point for us in that season is when we lost Carlos Ruiz, and it kind of changed our style of play. His hold up play was so important to us. And when he left, knock on Seba and Danny Mwanga, but they're not the player that Carlos Ruiz was in holding up the ball and how strong he was.
No, and just for some quick context, I don't mean to cut you off, but just for some quick context here, because you guys were playing, I think, two strikers like at the beginning of that season. And then like Peter shifted, and I think I remember seeing a little bit more like 4-5-1 there for some time where Mike Farfan came in, and then Velko was signed. And I think you kind of were running like a five-man midfield for a little bit.
Yeah, it just like really changed the way we played, and it kind of hurt us, especially, you know, once we were having the success in the style that we were playing, to then kind of go and change that midseason so drastically, I think really hurt us. So that was definitely an opportunity wasted, I think, that year. You know, once you get into the playoffs, you never know, you know, what can happen. And I think that if that team had stuck together in its entirety, and even losing Jordan Harvey, I think Gabe came in and did a great job, but, you know, Gabe wasn't naturally left-footed. That 2013 season, I don't think Hackworth will ever get enough credit for. You know, without going into too much details, he wasn't really, you know, who did we sign that year? You know, like he didn't get much help.
Jeff Park?
Yeah. And he didn't get much help in that standpoint. And we were competitive in every game. I think we were in every game except for maybe one or two. That just might not have been our days, but to take that young of a team and to have that success, I thought was definitely, you know, at the time, the good building blocks. And then unfortunately, we just, like I said, he just never got the help, I think, from the front office at that point in time to really build out that roster to see what it could have become.
Yeah, that was weird too, because, and I don't have enough time to go into all this, is probably like a separate podcast on its own, but, you know, Diego Gutierrez was there for a little bit. Peter was doing whatever he was doing with the transfer. So I think the big storylines of 2013 were Freddie Adu and making the swap with Kleberson. You know, Jeff Park came in as well. But it was kind of like a weird situation. It was like a stabilization period, you know? So it's like, hey, let's fix all this shit. Right. And then, you know, we can't give you all these reinforcements, but Jeff was a good defender that year for the 1 year he was there. And otherwise what Hack did was just kind of like elevate guys from within and got a lot out of it. I remember that like second game of the year, like, I think like you guys went out to Colorado and it was like snow piled up or whatever, but like a Moby scored and Jack scored and you guys like won like two in a row or something.
Exactly. It was actually a snowstorm game that had gotten snowed out, and then we ended up having to play the next day or whatnot. But like I said, we were really competitive with the roster that we had, and it was a roster that was of guys that was already on the team.
Yeah.
You know, we added, I think in his time, Chaco and Vince, who are two of, I think, the Union's better players all time.
Yeah, I loved watching those guys play, man. Loved
they were amazing.
Yeah.
Chaco, the 1 year, had 20 assists, and Vince was unbelievable. So those are two good teams that, I like I said, just never got to be completed by Hack. And then Jim did a good job of steadying the ship, and, you know, talk about good memories. The U.S. Open Cup, it was a great experience for a young team in our home stadium. We were so close.
Yeah,
we, you know, fine margins and Vince hitting the posts and then us, you know, conceding a goal. So
I can still picture that in my head, man. I see the motion in my head of him jumping up and trying, like, because the ball hopped up at a weird height and he kind of did like an awkward scissor. Like, he wasn't sure if he had time to wait for it to come down. So he went up and kind of like scissor half volleyed it or something right off the post. I can, like, it's like burned into my memory, man.
And that right there, that's the game. So, like I said, it's you know, a lot of things, you know, go your way, and a lot of things don't go your way. So you take the good and the bad, and, you know, and you see what you come out with.
Zoom tells me I have 4 minutes here, plenty of time. What kind of operation am I running here? Do you have a favorite goal or favorite assist? My favorite Shannon Williams Union goal was the flick on from, I think it was Brian Carroll. Then you had kind of the, like, the acrobatic something or other at the far post there.
That was a good one. That's definitely one of my favorites. You know, now that I'm coaching, that's usually the highlight that comes up the most with the kids. So they like.
Weird having them like Google you and show you highlights of your playing?
They always are Googling, and for the most part, like, because soccer is not as big as maybe some other places, like, they might not know that I actually played for like the first month or so. Until like one of them like will bring it up, or a coach will say something, and then all of a sudden the Googling starts. And then favorite assist, I think it was a Columbus game. It was CJ Sapong played me down the line. And then I think I touched it around one of their defenders, ran in and then squared it for Seba. And it was just definitely one of my favorite moments. That place used to get buzzing. Definitely had some really fun memories in that stadium. And even when I go there now, I wish I could, you know, jump on the field and kick around a little bit. You know?
I know. I'm 37 years old and I still go out and try to play. I'll keep trying to play until my legs fall off. Because if I go like 2 weeks at a time without playing, I get really like antsy and itchy. And my wife gets annoyed with me. And she's like, just go play. Go to YSC. Go play like a Friday game or something, you know. So
that's what helps with the coaching. I have 15 and 16-year-old boys. So from now and then I jump in and run around for a little bit, which helps not want to. It eases the itch of playing for me. Just get around and get a sweat. So it's been fun, you know, going into the coaching world and seeing that side of things. Because when you're a player, you just kind of get to practice and you're like, all right, what are we doing?
But
the has to put together everything and make sure that things are humming. So it's been a good learning process for me as I start it.
1:45 here. Final question for you. What do you want to do? Do you like broadcasting? Do you want to expand broadcasting? Do you want to expand on your coaching? What's kind of like the 2 or 3 year plan here?
I definitely really am focused on my coaching. I think it's something that I really enjoy. I enjoy working with the kids, and I think it's something that I would want to do long-term. The broadcasting has also been fun. It's been nice to, like I said, get to work on that side of things for myself and see where it takes me. You know, if something were to come about in the broadcasting side of things, I definitely would consider it and take it seriously. Like you said, there's so many, you know, ex-players that are doing such a good job and are having so much fun with it. So it's definitely something that I'm, you know, excited to continue to learn and grow in.
Shane, thanks for your time, man. I appreciate it. If we do this again sometime, I'll figure out Zoom so I'm not running some fugazi operation here. But I would just like to say I appreciate you coming on. I appreciate you always being available in the locker room and always you know, giving us quotes and whatnot. So I'll have to bump into you down at the stadium one of these days.
Yeah, man, I think I'm broadcasting later on this month at some point. So if you're around, definitely come in and say hello.
Absolutely. Shaden Williams, everybody, thanks for coming on.
Yeah.
And we'll talk to you soon, man. All right, we're going to get to your questions and comments and concerns momentarily. But first, I want to address the Negadelphia about the Orlando result and the L.A. result. Well, I mean, we already talked about the L.A. and the, you know, the regular season stuff, the MLS play with Shannon, but the Open Cup, like, I gotta be honest with you guys, like, I don't give a shit about the Open Cup. I really don't. Not this year. I think in years past, when the team was crap and we knew they weren't going to make the playoffs or they weren't going to be a cup contender if they did make the playoffs, we looked at the USOC as kind of like, oh, here's a chance to win something. You know, here's a chance to make this whole, you know, dog and pony show worth it. You know, maybe we can rip off 4 wins in a row or 5 wins in a row and get to the cup final and do it. You know, so in 2014, 2015, 2018, you know, I felt different about the Open Cup. Last night I watched that game. I was like, yeah, whatever. You know, now they can focus on the, you know, the domestic campaign, as they say, right? So I'm not really worried about that at all. I also think there's an element of you can't have it both ways kind of going on here. So what I mean by that is, you know, a lot of people are bitching and moaning because we're not seeing enough of the young guys. I was one of those guys for sure. So you can lump me in with that. Like, we're not seeing enough of Paxton. We're not seeing enough of Quinn Sullivan. Give me Jack McGlynn, right? Okay, well, we got all that, you know, and then they lost anyway. So I'm not like, there's a greater story to be told here about Jim Curtin's squad rotation or lack thereof or selections or whatever, but I didn't look at that game last night and feel one way or another. I was like, all right, you know, it's a tough draw going down to Orlando after having to play at LAFC, having to play at Nashville, like 4 or 5 on the road, whatever. It is what it is. So I didn't really think too much of it, you know, and it was kind of weird because I was, you know, making dinner and putting the girls to bed and all that stuff before the Sixers game and trying to, like, watching on my phone, carrying my phone around or whatever. But I didn't feel like I was, like, attached to it one way or another. So let me see what you guys have for me. Biggest surprise, this is from Jared. Biggest surprise and biggest disappointment so far this season. He's going to go with Harriel's development as the best surprise. But he says it's also his disappointment because I loved watching him Bizo last year. biggest surprise for me, I think, is Daniel Gajdag, not because I didn't expect him to be bad, but I didn't expect him to be this good. So he's really turned the corner for sure. And biggest disappointment's very easy to me. It's Ua, you know, and I know that you're putting the asterisk on it because he's been injured and he had the visa shit and time to settle. But you're a bunch of games into the season now and he's scored one goal. So when you put that into a vacuum, it is what it is, you know. Matt Thornton, a mediocre bad guy who provided the name for this podcast, has a list here. He says the positives from last night were Paxton's involvement, Flock playing the six in the Christmas tree, Stuart Finley not looking out of depth. And the negatives, he said, were Paxton's physicality, little involvement from McGlynn or Sullivan. It was Corey Burke's worst game. Yeah, positive. Paxton's movement is good. His involvement is there, you know. It's a little tough for him, I think, because, you know, in the system, he'd be playing as a 10, but you have Gajdag there. You know, when his brother came through, he was top of the depth chart at the number 10. So there's a little bit of a logjam there that has to clear for him, you know. You're not going to drop Karanzer. You're not going to drop Uar if he's available. So, you know, if you're looking at an option of playing, like, Paxton as, like, a second striker or a number 2 striker with, you know, Gajdag as the 10, I don't know if that's feasible. I don't know if it's viable. Flock, yeah, I thought he looked fine in the Christmas tree. You know, on the first goal, though, or was it the second goal? I think it was the first goal. There was a miscommunication there, I think, with McGlynn, and they both got skinned, and so Matt Real had to step up and try to address the ball carrier, and then there was a wide-open winger on that side, so they kind of fluffed that a little bit, but it's to be expected when you're playing Christmas tree for the first time this year, and you have a bunch of guys on the field who haven't been playing much this year, especially not playing with each other. So I guess, you know, it is what it is in that. Stuart Finley, I mean, I thought he looked fine. He got the goal, right? He wasn't at fault for either one of the goals. Not that I recall. No, he wasn't. And look, you know, that one where he slides and he pokes the ball out of there, you know, it rolls to an Orlando guy and, you know, he hits a cracker back in. There's nothing much else you can do with it. Actually, Glesnes on that goal got wrong-sided on a ball that was kind of floating in there and allowed the ball to be held up, and so I'd put the error more on him for that one for sure. Finley was just trying to clean up a Glesnes mistake there for sure, but I think the thing with Stuart Finley is that he looks kind of awkward at times, you know. I don't know if you guys agree with me on this or not, but I feel like Stuart Finley's got a little bit of Warren Cravall in him, where when the ball's coming to him or he's on it, he looks a little like uncomfortable, a little awkward, like the movements are not smooth, the movements are not fluid, but more often than not, he'll make the right pass or find the right guy. I remember there was a weird ball that came back in where Jack McGlynn played like this, like 40-yard diagonal backwards, trying to hit like a switch, and like Finley had to like bring it down and control it and get rid of it, and he did that. So I think he's serviceable for sure. I just think it's hard to say because we haven't seen too much of him, you know. What else is written here? Yeah, Paxton's not a big guy. He's not going to be physical. McGlynn's not going to be physical. I'll say this about McGlynn. I think I've said this before, but I don't think he's a 4-4-2 diamond guy, you know. And I think when they had some good moments with him last year is when they were playing out of the Christmas tree, right? So it's not surprising to me to see that he starts in the Christmas tree last night, you know, Tuesday night. And you know, to me, he just looks like a prototypical number 8 in like a 4-2-3-1 or something like that. You know, if you imagine him in like the Vince Noguera role or the Xabi Alonso role, where he got like a bulldog number 6 behind him, and then he can just kind of like, you know, get in the way defensively, but spray passes back and forth and ping the ball around, you know, with a line of 3 in front of him. I think that's probably what he's built for. So it's a little weird because I don't think he's necessarily totally built for what they do, you know. And Corey Burke, yeah, struggled, wasn't his best game either. A lot of running around without any kind of end product, you know. I don't think I have much to add on that you guys didn't already talk about on Twitter, you know. Here's a good question from Aiden. If you could change the outcome of one game through the Union's history, which one and why? I'd go back to what Shannon and I were talking about earlier. U.S. Open Cup 2014, for sure, man. Get that first trophy would have been amazing. Maybe it changes the fortunes of the franchise. I don't know. Yeah, maybe Nick Sakevich sticks around. Who the hell knows? You know? It would have been nice to see, for sure. You know, get that piece of hardware in there. And maybe it's just like, you know, the malaise of then 2015 through 2017 isn't really what it is. You know, maybe it helps the Union get on the scene in Philadelphia earlier. You know, maybe they get some respect earlier. And for people like me in the media, we can sell that shit. You know, hey, they won a trophy. Yeah, so I would do that. Or go back and, you know, do the semifinals of the playoffs last year with the 11 guys being out. You know, that's an easy one to pick for sure. Philadelphia Union in a MLS Cup final, you know. Couple like transfer window-ish kind of stuff here. Fear and Loathing in Chester. What do you think the Union ceiling is if Wagner leaves on a transfer midseason and Real has to step in? I mean, it's not a slight about Matt, but I think Kai is just that good that it's going to look a lot different there for sure. You could downgrade to anybody and it would, or you could go to anybody and it would look like a downgrade for sure. Klein says, do you see Mbizo asking for a move to increase his Cameroon World Cup squad chances? Yeah, I mean, I could see that. I could see a trade within MLS. Can they do trades within the year? Yeah, they can. Maybe he goes to a Western Conference team or something like that. You know, I'm not sure. But then behind Harriel, who is there? You know, like the Union have to have, aren't going to move Mbizo without a backup right back plan too, you know? So I think that's the other thing here. You know, they finally have – that's the problem with depth. You know, is that when you have guys who are worth playing, or if they want to go play somewhere else if they're not playing here. So it's a balancing act of trying to make it all work and keep everybody happy. This is from Alex. He said, Paxton looked legit last night. Burke and Santos just don't have the skill or savvy to play with this team. Yeah, I agree. You know, with Sergio and Corey, there's a lot of like – you know, it's like jamming the square peg in the round hole, direct, like runs, aerial wins, route one, kind of, I'm just going to like run you over, you know. It's not a lot of finesse with them. And you look at Julian Carranzer in the LA game, has an amazing secondary assist coming off like a Christian Pulisic looking type of run. And then he has the brilliant left-footed curler for the goal, you know. As a quick A-side, he was ball-watching on the equalizer, but that's all right. He's a striker. Like, what do you want, you know? He set up, he scored one goal and set up another one, so it's what more do you want from him? But, you know, what do you see Corey Burke or Sergio Santos doing any one of those things on offense that Carranzer was doing? They're not hitting like that one, you know, one touch to settle, turn around, left-footed curler. Or right-footed curler for that matter either. You know, they're not, you know, dribbling three guys and then playing a nice ball out wide to Kai Wagner for an assist. Like Sergio and Corey just aren't doing that, you know. So I think that's why you got to hold on to hope that Ua and Carranzer becomes a stable and consistent pair, because you're going to need some quality up there, you know. Those two with Gajdag can get you back to the semifinals of the playoffs for sure. Aiden says odds for McGlynn in the featherweight UFC title, very little. Volkanovski would have his way. Chris says, do you think they should have started with a stronger lineup last night? Also, why was the stadium so empty? I don't know. It's hard for me to say, because I think that they just don't care about the Open Cup this year. I think that they're a title contender. You know, and there hasn't been a lot of squad, you know, movement, a lot of change in the starting lineup. Maybe they just got caught in a thing where it's like, all right, here's an opportunity to play some guys. But, you know, it wasn't the Rochester Rhinos, you know, it wasn't the Harrisburg City Islanders or whatever they're called now, Penn FC, right? It wasn't the New York Cosmos, you know, it wasn't DC United at the Boyd's Soccerplex, right? You know, you got to get on a plane and go to Florida, so... So I don't know. This is from Matt. We need one of our three young midfielders to level up the way Brendan did to reach our ceiling. It looks like Paxton's skills are the closest, but McGlynn at times seems to lack the physicality or speed needed to be that difference maker. I agree, and that goes kind of back to the point that I was making of him not really being a guy for this system. Like, he's not, he's a finesse player with a good left foot. He is very slow. And so you're not going to really count on him to like cluster press or to be able to read a cue and like be the second or third guy up on somebody's back or to try to jar the ball loose and go direct. I mean, he's more of a, like, when I watch him play, he's more of a, like a traditional, let's get on the ball and knock it around kind of player. So I'm interested to see how that affects him developmentally, you know, if they try to not shoehorn him, but if they try to like work him into the system, or if they try to like, you know, use him in Christmas tree or other formations, or if they come up with a backup, you know, like a plan B option, like they did with El Seno in years past. This is Union Hulk checking in. Now listen, you're not going to believe it, but this is in all caps, this tweet. He says, can we promise to never talk about that squeaky fart in an elevator that was the U.S. Open Cup game? What the fuck did we just not care about that game? Fucking Tony Orlando played Pato and Dupe rolled in the bench. What the fuck, Kevin Digne? What the fuck? I don't know either, but like I said, man, I don't care. I don't, man. You know, I'm sorry. I mean, maybe I should care, but I just don't give a fuck about the Open Cup this year. You know? I just don't, you know? That's kind of like a conversation I have with my 3-year-old, you know? I say, why don't you want to wear your socks? She says, because I don't want to wear them. You know, it's not an explanation, but she just, you know, she doesn't want to wear the socks. So, Jim C. says, prediction time, will Ur be the next Maurice Adu? Oh, God. He says, yes, it's unfair to judge this early, but he's been out with a couple injuries already. It was a stress fracture that then became, Maurice's thing was like a Markel Fultz and Ben Simmons and Joel Embiid kind of thing. It was like thoracic outlet syndrome wrapped into the L4 lumbar, like wrapped into the navicular and presented, to you, the fan, on a shit platter, you know? So, I have like a whole 2-page email from somebody on the union staff, like explaining to me like what exactly happened with Maurice, because I think at the time I was reporting that the injury happened when he was away from the team, which is true, but it wasn't like the team's fault or whatever, if you know what I mean. I don't have it in front of me now, but that email is saved somewhere. I don't think the person who sent it to me would care if I read it publicly at this point. I don't know if he's even with the team anymore, but remind me for the next podcast. Maybe I can go back and look at the Maurice Adu email and read exactly like what it said, or give you the gist of that, because it explained his off season like program and what the deal is like working with other people outside of the team, or like training on your own, you know? So, to answer the question, no. Trey says, who do you think will end up being the leading goal scorer for the U this season? I think it'll be Carranzer. He says, also, what was your favorite and least favorite part of playing in the Casa League? Shout out Fishtown FC. Oh, favorite and least favorite part of Casa? Well, I think my least favorite was playing on like the just shit fields, you know, for a while. You know, we played in Northeast Philly for a while. You know, Parkwood, like you get a gust of wind, or not Parkwood, it was the one behind the prison up there on the river, the one on the river, where if you get like a gust of wind, the ball would roll all the way into the river. You know, you'd have to chase it like 50 yards or whatever. Or just going around all the different turf fields and like killing your knees, like playing in South Philly and playing at Chestnut Hill Academy and what. I mean, it was tough because I don't know what you want them to do. It's not like there's a abundance of beautiful grass fields in Philly, but you know, maybe having to go to Northeast Philly and play at every shithole in Northeast Philly for 10 years, perhaps that's the thing. My favorite thing was just like being able to play at a high level, you know? You know, the picture that I have on my Twitter banner, that was from 2015 South Philly FC. I was getting old at that point. I was already like, I was in my 30s at that point. So I was like a bench guy, backup, kind of utility knife on that team, you know? But, you know, that team had two former pros. It had Thorne Holder, who played for the Union, was our goalkeeper. There was a guy who played for the Ocean City Nor'easters against the Union in the Open Cup that one year. He was on that CASA team. And we had a bunch of guys from Widener University too. So there was like, I was like playing with former college guys and former pros, and like there was a USL guy there too. So, you know, I always told myself, like, cause I stopped playing after high school. I didn't play in college, you know? But I always thought that was cool about CASA, was that like, you know, you have like former pros, former college guys, former like, you know, really good amateur players. So like the quality at the top was really damn good, you know? So it's nice to be able to at least like think you could hang with those guys, or at least play 90 minutes with them. You know, it's like a nice, like just, I don't know, like confidence boost or something to think like, hey, I didn't play past Boyertown, you know, but you know, now I'm able to at least hold my own playing against, you know, former college guys and some, you know, former like USL guys, you know, so that was cool. Let me see here. Amish Terp says, please get Burke out of my life, please. Brian says, is there really nobody in the academy better than Burke? Yeah, people are down on Corey after last night for sure. Sully, I'll leave it on this one. Sully says, what's it going to take to right the ship? The last month has been awful. 0-2-3. Consecutive blown leads after 80, waving the white flag in the USOC a day before you play. How have we bottomed out thoroughly so fast? To Sully, I would say, not so fast, my friends, as Lee Corso once said. You know, I don't think that's anything close to bottoming out. I think in what he says there, I think the one thing that we didn't talk about was them conceding the late goals. You know, two blown leads after 80. Carranza fell asleep. On the set piece that Andre spilled, which is just, you know, he's trying to push that wherever he can. He's just trying to get a hand on it. So that was disappointing. The Nashville one, it's like, I don't know. What can you say? Like, they were pushing. There's like a goofy penalty. You know, they probably got lucky that there wasn't another penalty called. And I think if you told me at the beginning of either one of those games that they would go to Nashville in their new stadium and go to LAFC and they get a point out of each of those against playoff teams, top, you know, three teams from either league, at least last year, I would have been more than happy with that from the beginning. You know, it doesn't mean we can't move the goalposts to say, hey, they could have got more out of those games, but I'm not super worried about it. You know, like Shannon said, they're taking points along the way. They're still first place in the Eastern Conference. In a way, I'm happy that people feel so strongly about the Union and have such high expectations for them that they're going to do some justified Negadelphia, but I'm the funny thing is that I'm usually, you guys say like I'm the snarky, sarcastic, like sardonic one, you know, right? It's like me and Matt DeGeorge, you know, we're like the when somebody did the Dungeons and Dragons thing with all the media members, like we were like chaotic evil, you know, on the thing. And like, here I am saying like, hey, I think it's good. I think the Negadelphia is dumb. I'm like fine with where they are. You know, I don't give a shit about the Open Cup. So it's a rare occasion where I'm Positadelphia and everybody's negative. Negadelphia. So I almost said Megadeth there. So tells you what I'm about to do. Make some lunch and listen to Thrash. All right. It's no Negadelphia. It's Positadelphia, everybody. All right. See ya.